The topic for this evening's discussion is understanding Buddhist emptiness. A core concept and realization in the cultivation of awakening is sunyata, which is translated as emptiness or voidness. This seems to be a very mysterious term. It is somewhat mysterious in actuality. Often misunderstood as nihilism, which is the absence of value, any kind of value or any fundamental truth regarding, you know, our lived experience. Actually, the word sunyata is the antithesis of another word, svabhava, which translate as intrinsic nature or self-being. So sunyata declares that subjective experience is empty of any essential nature. So in this regard, it's synonymous with anatta, the absence of an enduring autonomous self. So that's a basic understanding of it. As I was preparing these notes, I forgot to put this into my notes, but when I was in college back in the 1960s, I was very interested in existentialism. And I believe it was Jean-Paul Sartre, a very famous existential philosopher, who wrote a book called Being in Nothingness, which is, I think, very much about this. I actually read Being in Nothingness back in the day because I took every course on existentialism I could take at the University of Florida. So I'm pretty sure I read it, but I hadn't thought about it for a long time. But it's also very interesting to have that kind of Western understanding. As far as I know, Sartre had no idea about Buddhism. So this notion of absence of an enduring autonomous self. Let's dive into that a little bit. First of all, subjective experience is inherently transitional, constantly changing in terms of what arises and passes away in our conscious experience. So this is called anicca. The concept is anicca in Buddhism. And the other aspect of anatta is the absence of an autonomous self. Now, what's that mean? Well, our subjectivity is not autonomous. It's not fixed. There's no little self that's abiding somewhere in the brain or the body. In fact, what's going on is that the creation of self-states depends on multiple interactive functions that are constantly varying. First of all, there's external sensory stimulation changing all the time. Then there are levels of metabolic energy that are providing nurturance for the emergence of a self-state. That's changing. Feelings within a self-state that affect to a greater or lesser extent are impulsive reactivity, which we call affective responses, changing all the time. And previous experience is constantly shaping what actually emerges into consciousness that is integrated through craving and clinging into what we call the self. These dynamic and complex interactions are manifestations of what is called interdependence. Interdependence is a basic concept that's related to paticca samuppada, which is typically translated to dependent origination. I prefer to understand paticca samuppada as contingent provisional emergence. If you are curious about that, well, the notes here have it in there, and you can post it. You can read it there. But if you Google contingent provisional emergence on the Google and the internet, it'll take you right to an archived rendering of the notes on that. So interdependence also has this logical function. Because A exists, in the way that it exists, it supports the existence of B. When the existence of A changes, B also changes. So you think about just A and B and the variability there. In terms of interdependence, the complexity of the process of the universe doesn't just include A and B, but the whole alphabet. Not just the whole alphabet in a kind of A to B relationship, but A related to all the other letters of the alphabet through to Z, and B to all the letters of the alphabet from A through Z, so forth and so on. Extraordinarily complex. So this alphabet soup that we call interdependence suggests that our personalities are constructs, they're fabrications that are built around cultural norms, familial influences, other externally prompted references. And that is combined with, you know, your history, your karma, if you will, that interprets all these different stimuli. So this in contemporary psychology is called phenomenology. And directly applies to anatta. In that case, then there's no such thing as an innate self. No svabaha. Now, several centuries after the historical Buddha, the Mahayana school of Buddhism included a very important commentator named Nagarjuna, who some consider as the second Buddha. Some commentators say that. But he was a very important interpreter of the original Buddhist teachings. And there's a term in Buddhism called Madhyamaka. Madhyamaka is usually translated as the middle way. The middle way was something that was intrinsic in the original Buddhist teachings. His understanding of it represented a deep understanding of one of the earlier suttas, the Kaccha Nigodha Sutta. I'm going to read a quote from that now that describes this middle way. By and large, Kachayana, this world is supported by a polarity, that is existence and non-existence. But when one reads the origination of the world as it actually is, with right discernment, non-existence with reference to the world does not occur to one. When one reads the cessation of the world as it actually is, with right discernment, existence with reference to the world does not occur to one. By and large, Kachayana, the world is in bondage to attachments, clingings, sustenances, and bases. But one such as this does not get involved with or cling to these attachments, clingings, fixations of awareness, biases, or obsessions, nor is he resolved on myself. He has no uncertainty or doubt that just distress when arising is arising. Distress when passing away is passing away. In this, his knowledge is independent of others. It's to this extent, Kachayana, that there is right view. Everything exists. That is one extreme. Everything doesn't exist. That is a second extreme. Avoiding these two extremes, the Tathagata teaches the Dhamma via the middle way. Well, I mentioned Paticca Samuppada. Nagarjuna was also deeply studied that concept. And this led him to a view about the universe, not just the human personality, but the universe. Initially, in early Buddhism, this notion of Paticca Samuppada, of interdependence, of anatta, sunyata, is intended to deconstruct the sense of an enduring autonomous self. I already described that. But this became more elaborated to involve the entire universe. Now, once again, this becomes, seems to be mysterious, but contemporary physics dives into this area as well. And these physicists really have no idea of Mahayana Buddhism or Madhyamaka. So here's an excerpt from an article called Through the Lens of Madhyamaka by Dzogchen Donlap Rinpoche. It's in the Lion's Roar magazine. Consider a table. What exactly is the thing we call a table? What is the basis of the label, table? Contrary to a conventional understanding, the basis is not a single entity. It has many parts, a top, sides, legs, and so forth. And if we look closely at each part, we can say that each of them, in turn, is made up of different parts. Each leg also has a top, sides, and so forth. If we continue to examine each of those parts, we will discover that each of them is composed of atomic particles. And if we further observe each atomic particle, we'll find even smaller subatomic particles. Eventually, we'll arrive at a tiny unit, the irreducible, partless particle. But if we continue and break down that partless particle through analysis, nothing solid or real is found. Modern physics and Madhyamaka reasoning came to almost the same conclusion regarding the existence of external phenomena. Madhyamaka calls that state in which nothing existent is found at the subatomic level emptiness or shunyata, whereas the scientific community posits hypothetical entities, zero-dimensional or mathematical representations, and uses these labels for them, such as quarks, strings, or energy fields. Even though there's nothing there, these scientific terms create the illusion that there is something to hold on to. Instead of experiencing the rug being pulled out from under our feet, such labels provide a sense of ground or something to stand on. Madhyamaka analysis offers no such reassurance. Instead, it leads us to total groundlessness. So basically, what that quote is saying is that the terms such as quarks and strings and so forth, they themselves are empty of inherent meaning. They're just useful terms. The mathematics that describes them is empty, but it's very useful in terms of manipulating these various atomic structures, molecules, and whole societies. So, now, this Mahayana view, Madhyamaka, was transported by Buddhist missionaries to Tibet and China and had a significant impact on the development of Vajrayana, Chinese Chan, and Korean and Japanese Zen. Core understanding of sunyata and interdependence supports the bodhisattva principles that are dominant in those schools. Of course, they're implicit within the original teaching of the Buddha, but I think that Mahayana puts more emphasis on emptiness, whereas Theravada school put more emphasis on impermanence, just exploring impermanence. They both amount to the same thing. I mean, if you look very, very closely at your subjective experience, it is arising and passing away multiple times a second. And that certainly implies emptiness as well, in terms of enduring autonomous selfhood. But within the context of Madhyamaka, there's an emphasis on loving kindness, on compassion, on sympathetic joy. This is based on the notion that due to interdependence, we're all in this together. So even though there's this fundamental absence of essence, there's our experience subjectively that we live in. And this is a very key understanding to cultivate, that subjectively, interpersonally, culturally, scientifically, we operate in a world that is dualistic, that has a subject and an object, or a mover and that which is moved. But at this deep, deep layer of analysis, it simply doesn't exist. Within the Heart Sutra of the Mahayana tradition, a very, very important discourse, there's another understanding about sunyata. So this is from an article by a fellow named Carl Brunhold, also from Lion's Roar. One thing we can safely say about the Heart Sutra is that it is completely crazy. If we read it, it does not make any sense. Well, maybe the beginning and end makes sense, but everything in the middle sounds like a sophisticated form of nonsense, which can be said to be the basic feature of the Prajna Paramita Sutras in general. If we like the word know, we might like the sutra, because that's the main word it uses. Know this, know that, know everything. We could also say that it's a sutra about wisdom, but it is a sutra about crazy wisdom. When we read it, it sounds nuts, but that is actually where the wisdom part comes in. What the Heart Sutra, like all the Prajna Paramita Suttas, does is to cut through, deconstruct, and demolish all of our usual conceptual frameworks, all our rigid ideas, all our belief systems, all our reference points, including any with regard to our spiritual path. It does so on a very fundamental level, not just in terms of thinking and concepts, but also in terms of our perception, how we see the world, how we hear, how we smell, taste, touch, how we regard and emotionally react to ourselves and others, and so on. The sutra pulls the rug out from underneath our feet and does not leave anything intact that we can think of, nor even a lot of things that we cannot think of. Well, those of you who have heard me teach before know that I really like to relate these ancient teachings to what's going on in the contemporary world, neuroscientifically, and in terms of contemporary social psychology or personal psychology. So, in terms of emptiness, here's some comments about from a neurological process perspective. First, I'm going to refer to a book by research scientist and meditator Daniel Siegel. Book I'm referring to had a big impact on me. Pocket Guide to Interpersonal Neurobiology, an Integrative Handbook of the Mind. In chapter 29, he begins a complex description of how contingent provisional emergence, once again my terms, operates. The title of the chapter is The Plane of Possibility. So I'm not going to quote that. I'm going to give you my rendering of it. So first of all, he describes the brain as a system that transforms the basic energy provided by food and oxygen into information and action. And this occurs through the networking of billions of neurons in the brain that extend out through the body, through the hormonal system and so forth and so on, as well as through very large nerve complexes like the vagal nerve complex. The connections between neurons are so numerous and thoroughly complex in their interconnections that, considering a basic process of self-organization, the potential for interpretation for every stimulus, every moment of stimulation, approaches infinity. So this is what he calls the baseline of the plane of possibility. So the baseline is infinite or empty. It's another way to describe it. So that system gets stimulated somehow. In the Paticca Samuppada, that happens through what's called contact. There's a stimulus, and this stimulus very, very rapidly, the system reiterates multiple times a second. Once again, according to contemporary neuropsychology, but also in terms of ancient Buddhist teaching, in the Suttamagga, for example. So there's this initial impulse that enters into this complex system, and perception starts to operate. Perception, what it does is it separates out one particular part of the stimulus flow from the other parts and kind of hones in on that. And that elaborates into larger and larger interpretive systems. This elaboration is called papancha in Buddhist psychology. Proliferation around a stimulus, a seed moment. So as this process elaborates, it kind of creates what would be considered to be like a pyramid. The base, like I said, is so complex and so dynamically operating that it has infinite possibilities for certainty, for a moment of self-organization. But as the process operates, that possibility function becomes narrower and narrower and narrower till it gets to the moment of self-awareness and consciousness, at which point what starts out is to be an infinite possibility, emptiness, becomes a certainty. It's still a fabrication. It's still empty of intrinsic being, but we certainly experience it as this is myself, this is the world. So that's one way to understand what's going on in this personification process of the way the brain operates. Now, this doesn't just operate within the structure of the brain, it also radiates out through the vagal process, out into the body, because the body is responding almost instantaneously, particularly in the torso, to this kind of emergence, but then sends signals back into the brain that participate in this crescendo operation that comes to a peak moment of selfing, of certainty. This is who I am, this is how the world is. Once again, it's still about craving and clinging, attachment to a view. From a different perspective, or an elaboration of that perspective, let's talk about the skin. We experience being embodied, within this organ that we call the skin. It seems to be distinctive and creates a boundary between myself and the world. However, when it's examined more closely, the skin is somewhat porous. There are liquids and gases moving across the skin, both entering into and leaving the body all the time. Sweat's the most obvious example. Now, if you extend that out to the esophagus, you know, the inner lining of the lungs and the digestive tract, same thing applies. It's permeable. So if you look even closer at those tissues, down to the molecular level, the boundary between the external and the internal becomes even less discernible. And you go to the atomic level, just like I was talking about with that quote from about physics, there's more space than there is substance, and the substance itself is, you know, a quark, so to speak. It's a subatomic energy bundle of some sort. So now, in terms of meditation practice, I've done a lot of practicing of the body scanning, the Veda Nupassana practice. And there are times when I'm deep in that practice when the sense of a boundary that defines where my body leaves off and the rest of the universe begins just dissolves. I don't mean physically. It's not interesting anymore. The mind is not inclined to organize around that. So it's in that sense, it feels kind of empty. Or if there's anything there, it's a vibratory field. Another way it could be described is through jhana practice, particularly what are called the formless jhanas. Get to a certain level of concentration in the mind. The same phenomena occurs, but at a much more profound and subtle level. The whole notion of there being a separate self kind of dissolves into a kind of infinite awareness. The Buddha, before his awakening, cultivated this, the formless jhanas. And some people in those days thought that that was liberation from dukkha. He did not believe that, because as soon as the jhana states were gone, the world came crashing back in again. The way he described it is that cultivating high degrees of samadhi is like chopping off weeds at ground level. Everything looks clear, it's fine, so forth. But because the roots are still there and they're still being nurtured, the weeds grow back up again. So cultivating jhana is like chopping, or samadhi is like chopping the weeds off at ground level. But vipassana practice, the discovery or realization of emptiness, is like starving the roots. And that's what really, truly liberates the mind from dukkha, full potential of sunyata. So here's another quote from the Open Encyclopedia of Anthropology that talks about the sociology of emptiness. When phenomenologists and phenomenological anthropologists write about experience, they're primarily concerned with describing the essential conditions of experience. Therefore, rather than simply providing a description of a series of events and activities that accumulate over time and shape a person's life, phenomenologists investigate and describe the potentialities and relationships that make experience possible in the first place. Rather than really merely describing that a homeless person in Boston may be struggling along, phenomenological anthropologists will also investigate which conditions led to this predicament in the first place and offer a way for understanding how these conditions shape lives. So struggling along, basically what that means is that in the background of any person's life, there are all the prior experience, the karmic influences that shape how that person's self-experience is fabricated, and their behavior that emerges from that. And phenomenology tends to deconstruct the notion that there is a resulting self, it's more along the lines that let's take a look at the phenomena that are going on here, how this works phenomenologically, rather than buying into the notion that there's an essential self. So let me talk about that a little bit. We experience interpersonal relationships. In psychology, they're called, it's called attachment theory. Not the same thing as in Buddhism in terms of attachment as a misrepresentation of reality. It's more along the lines of what goes on between two people and how does that affect each personality. So this creates an interpersonal or social self. Now we're still talking about non-self here, about emptiness. We are influenced and influencing each other all the time. It's another way to think about interdependence. From the moment we're born, the interactions that we have with others, primarily caregivers, influences the caregiver's behavior and their sense of who they are. You ask any parent what it's like after a child is born. Yeah, it's different now because of that influence. Alternatively, the child's personality depends on those interactions. Back to that person who's struggling along. They probably have some kind of psychological history that disables their ability to function effectively in society. Either biologically they have a problem, like, I don't know, bipolar disorder, or they have family of origin issues. I was a professional psychologist for decades, so this is my bailiwick, understanding these issues. So the gist of this is that different factors shape who we think we are. These factors are impersonal. I use my own experience as an example often. I was born with a cis male identity. Now these days, many young people are not caught up into gender identity the way my generation was. I was also born in the US. I was born right after World War II, a baby boomer. Born Caucasian. I grew up in an alcoholic family, a depressed alcoholic family. So all of these conditioned my sense of self. There was nothing inherently real or substantial or enduring or autonomous about the development of personality. It's a dynamic, impersonal process. Now, if I had been born 10 years earlier, during or just prior to World War II, my formative years would have shaped a different sense of who I am in the world. And if I had been born many years after I was, there would be a different kind of impact on my sense of self. If I had been born a Gen X person, it would be very different than the way I am operating as an adult. So this is another way to understand emptiness, non-self, anatta. Once again, one might think that this is nihilistic, hopeless, being stuck with ignorance. But there's another way to look at emptiness. And the Buddha actually said this when he started talking about awakening. He said, if I did not think that you could realize awakening, I wouldn't be teaching this, but I know that awakening is possible and that there are people who are sufficiently prepared to realize awakening, liberation from dukkha. So emptiness means that because we're making it up as we go along, because the sense of self is essentially empty, we can change. Of course, we talk about neurobiological change that neural pathways can be modified. And because that can happen, we can change. We can develop different personalities. Now, that development is difficult. It's the work of a lifetime, really. Certainly been the work of my lifetime, and I've been practicing Buddhism for over half my life now. But we can change. So there is hope. It just depends on what kind of system we use for change and how diligent we are in cultivating the craft of changing, creating a new self. It's more adaptive through neuroplasticity. Now, I'm going to read an extensive quote from another book that's been very influential for me and any number of my students. We actually studied this book, I think, at least once, maybe more than once, in intensive study groups that I've been conducting for years. It's a book by a fellow named Rodney Smith. It's titled Stepping Out of Self-Deception, The Buddha's Liberating Teaching of No Self. This book is not a page turner. It is a page contemplator. And this is a comment I often hear. You know, I read a passage in the book and I have to read it again. Not because it's incomprehensible, but because it is so well constructed, so impactful. So go along for the ride with me as I read this rather long excerpt from the book. It's in two parts. The first one is called Perpendicular Universes. The laws of the unconditioned, which we will call the vertical, are inherently contradictory to the laws of the conditioned, which we will call the horizontal. The horizontal and the vertical are perpendicular to one another, but do bisect at one location, the present. The vertical is, and that's all about one can say about it. The vertical requires nothing to be added because nothing is missing. It is intrinsic to all things, but makes no demand upon them. It cannot be perceived because it is within perception itself. There's no way to it, and there's no way out of it. The horizontal world of conditioning is time-driven, labor-intensive, a multidimensional universe extending far beyond its junction with the vertical. To the left, as far as the mind can see, is time past, and to the right is the infinite expanse of time future. Since future and past have no reality outside thought, the horizontal universe is both composed and driven by concepts. This means it has no true authenticity other than the validity we give an idea or image. The only uncontested point is the here and now, at the place where it bisects with the vertical universe. The person living in the horizontal rarely acknowledges the touch of the vertical. There is little interest in a timeless universe. From the horizontal perspective, the present is a moment between time past and time future, a deprived moment on its way to some other time. The future holds the hope and potential. The present holds the pain of who I am now. So the momentum is to move quickly as quickly as possible away from the present of what I am in the direction of who I will become. The vertical perspective of the here and now is very different. Since the moment is not being squeezed between the rock of the past and the hard place of the future, it is open and expansive. In fact, it is infinite and total, encompassing all things, including thoughts about past and future, because all thoughts are occurring here and now. So the vertical universe actually encompasses the horizontal universe. Nothing could possibly escape the moment or ever be outside it. So the vertical universe is always abiding and never moves. Things move within it, but it never moves. Moment after moment, we are taking birth in the vertical universe. The problem is, we think we're in the horizontal. Occasionally, we pause sufficiently to see the intersection of these dimensions and not merely think our way past them. It may be a moment of wonder, mystery, beauty, or a moment too precious to deny. So that's the first excerpt. Now I have some comments about this. Sunyata, emptiness, is the bisection between the vertical and horizontal, the moment of wonder, mystery, beauty, or a moment too precious to deny. This moment is dynamically transitory, unbound by our subjective sense of time, and is captured by anticipation, craving, clinging to the potential of the next moment of horizontal experience, defined by the residue of the past moments. So here's another excerpt further on in the book that explores emptiness and timelessness. The vertical question. The vertical universe is unformed within stillness. A question is an entry into the vertical dimension because the nature of a question is unfixed and wide open, and therefore unformed. It shatters our worldview and is the essence of the Buddha's pointing, cling to naught. The state of inquiry is a return to innocence because it is a complete suspending of everything that is known. There's no way for the sense of self to acquire that stillness. Stillness is what remains after we stop trying to find it. And therefore, there is no strategy we can impose in order to stop. There is just stopping. In stopping, everything is its own fulfillment. Restlessness, wanting, fearing are all fulfilled in stopping. In the vertical dimension, these states of mind become complete in now because they have lost their unconscious reference to a personal narrative and are no longer tied to aversion or wanting. In the horizontal universe, these states of mind are fulfilled only after we attain what we want. Satisfaction occurs after states of mind have completed their mission, after we find what we need to offset the emotional hunger. If the horizontal stops at all, it is temporary and conditional upon discovering the objects that will show us, that will allow us to feel satiated. We begin to recognize that horizontal language produces a conditional and incomplete stopping, and therefore remains ultimately unsatisfactory. We perceive horizontal longings as irresolvable and their language as misguided untruths. We even mistrust our desires and their fulfillment. We feel cornered and lost with nowhere to go because it makes no sense to resume the language of an unconvincing thought. Stopping is what happens when we have nowhere to go and no thought to turn toward. The mind that is in movement on the horizontal plane sets the stage for our suffering to be unnecessarily lengthened. The horizontal dimension believes idle time is wasted time. And if we are not struggling to satisfy our desires, we are slipping backwards. The intention of the mind is to go anywhere, but not to stop here. The journey away from here fosters hope that rallies our energy and interest and keeps us leaning into tomorrow where a wanting can be satisfied. The mind will not allow itself to rest because to rest means it has run out of answers and has no solution to its dissatisfaction. It would then be helpless in the face of a problem of its own creation. Interesting. All the qualities of present moment awareness with vertical are empty, lacking inherent separateness. Pali word that describes this is tatata, translated as suchness or thusness. This represents a non-dualistic characteristic of reality that is equivalent to nirvana. Seven awakening factors of the mind are so unified and functionally and uninterested in the horizontal process that emptiness is evident, but not subject to the reemergence of the horizontal processes. As a result of the complete realization of anicca, which is the impermanent nature of human consciousness. After his awakening, the Buddha described himself as the Tathagata. Now, it's usually translated as thus gone, but I prefer to interpret it as mastery of suchness. This terminology sets aside any personalization regarding what occurs after total awakening. Realization of sunyata is achievable, but at the same time, undefinable and mysterious. This mystery is what is described in the Heart Sutra. Now, I hope that what I've been saying with you all, and if you upload the notes in the Dharma Talk, download them, I'm going to upload them tomorrow, it might be helpful in sorting this out. Now, let me encapsulate again. The notion of emptiness is not... it's easy to conceptualize when you realize, when you pay attention to the concept of interdependence. Everything is stirring all the time. But the mind builds a self around that. But there's no self inherent in that building. There's just that which is built. There's a book that I read many years ago, I can't remember the author's name, Thoughts Without a Thinker, that points to that. So that's what I have to say about emptiness for tonight. Any questions or comments about this before we close for the evening? All dazed and confused.
I have a question or a comment.
Yes, April.
So I'm following everything you're saying. I have a question about trauma in the body, and like for me, so it's interesting because I've been exploring if you've heard of the Nalanda Institute, I think it's called, it's like the Nalanda Contemplative Psychology, some sort of course. And anyway, so they had some things about ways when people have trauma, like in ways to work with exercises to dislodge the trauma on a like physiological level, right? So I'm thinking about not self, and I'm thinking about understanding this concept, and I understand how meditation and mindfulness, how we can shift and work with this, but I'm wondering about how to approach this concept in addition to the idea that trauma is somehow in the, you know, they say the issues are in the tissues, right? That it's like somehow in our cells and that some sort of process needs to happen to help people heal that trauma physiologically so that they can also like free themselves of the false sense of self.
Well, everything's a false sense of self. Even, you know, the traumatic false sense of self is just different than the non-traumatic false sense of self. I mentioned the vagal process, the vagus nerve. And there's been a lot of research on the association between dysfunction of the vagal nerve and trauma. Mm-hmm. And there's no on-off switch regarding that process. The vagus nerve connects to the base of the brain and extends out through the torso all the way down to the abdomen. And then another aspect of the vagus nerve extends from the abdomen, and it also contacts with other organs in the torso, goes back up to the brain. So there's this constant transmission going back and forth. Very complex, like I alluded to earlier in the talk. So what they're trying to understand is how trauma shocks both the neural networks in the brain and the neural hormonal processes in the body. Because the body communicates through hormones as well as nervous activity. Cortisol is strongly associated with trauma in the body. The assumption is that the more a person can cultivate samadhipassati, stability of attention and tranquility of the mind, the more opportunity there is for those disruptions that we call trauma to be reconditioned. Mm-hmm. But having said that, it's important to understand that it's not as though this process is about that kind of healing. It's about understanding that everything, whether it's trauma or non-trauma, every bit of it is empty of self. Mm-hmm. That realization is what this is pointing to. So I can't give you a definitive or reassuring answer to whether or not cultivating mindfulness in the way that I've been talking about it in terms of sunyata is going to resolve trauma. It'd just be there'll be an indifference to it psychologically, which may or may not impact the physiology of the body.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I've also been thinking about, and someone I did listen to on a podcast kind of mentioned this too, which is that, so we, when we understand this, and following on what you just said, then it gives you a little room to play as well, because then you're aware of this, that it's all not self, it's all fault, self, whatever, but you're also aware that there is something physiologically happening in the body, and then you can, as you sort of get this distance from it, maybe also you can find modalities that help you heal it. But then there's another interesting thing, which is I heard someone say that kind of the second thing you said was he almost got to the point where he knew the trauma was there, but he just wasn't reacting the same anymore, like it, in his case. And I know this is a huge conversation because, you know, there's some people who are going to tell you that their traumatic, whatever's going on with them is really strong, right? And so I'm also speaking from being a human that, although I'm sure I do have some trauma, obviously I've never been really incapacitated by a traumatic reaction or traumatic response. So I'm just curious, especially when it comes to working with other people, but thank you.
Well, let me comment about trauma too. Trauma is on a continuum. There's, you know, huge trauma, like what's happened to the families in Nashville with this horrible shooting. That's serious trauma. In fact, that mother who talked back to the authorities and went viral with that, saying, come on, aren't you tired of all this? You know, she's traumatized. So that's one level of trauma, but there are also what we could call attachment trauma. Now, I've talked about before about my attachment trauma has to do with abandonment. There are any number of events. Some of them were just my parents being so self-absorbed they couldn't respond to me in the way I needed them to, which is could be called traumatic. It's pretty minimal. But, you know, you can die from 1,000 small bleeding cuts rather than one deep stab wound. And real fears that my father driving drunk, my mother in the car, they would not come home at night, particularly if they were hours later than they said they were going to be. That's significant trauma in terms of relationships. It has an effect on my body, an effect on my psyche, and an effect on my adult relationships. Now, when my wife, she and I have been together a very long time, very happily married, She could die on the highway. Statistically, it's very, very unlikely, but she could die on the highway. So it pops into my brain, but it does not inhabit my body the way it used to. It used to inhabit my body as well as my brain. So that's what I'm thinking of when I talk about how dedicated meditation practice can bring some relief to that kind of trauma. But I've never had a near-death experience. I've never witnessed someone up close and personal dying violently. I've never killed anybody. So, you know, I don't have that level of trauma, but I have the attachment trauma experience.
Yes. So as you know, I have something very similar. And what I have noticed is exactly what you said. I have noticed that as my practice has deepened, the experience of that pain in my body has changed, you know, for the better, right? So it's the cycles are faster, I'm able to regulate more quickly, and I'm definitely finding more peace, you know, physiologically. And then for the second thing you said, yeah, that is what I've been studying a little bit and getting some insight on people who actually go through some sort of you know, witnessing a fatal accident or something, as you said, and apparently what happens for those people is there's some correlation, there's something that happens in the brain, and these advanced therapists who work with them are able to do certain exercises that help them disassociate that trigger. Like, for instance, the smell of asphalt, like somebody, every time they would smell it, would get nauseous and throw up because it brought them back to like the accident, right? So there was something really interesting they were able to do to start to dislodge that from the person's nervous system or brain or something. So I just think it's really interesting in the sense that, yes, you can have the understanding of not self, and then there's still these things, because we are still a body, you know, there's still this process happening physiologically that we have these other techniques to hopefully help.
Yeah, people. And let me add to that, and then we're getting close to the end of our time tonight, by saying that those techniques by those therapists, I believe that a significant part of that intervention is the degree of integration of that therapist's personality, their presence in the relationship. You know, half of what allows therapy to work is confidence in the therapist. Different techniques, different approaches, different interventions and so forth. But the more a therapist can manifest what's called attachment security, stable presentation, consistent, caring, thoughtful, so forth and so on, that has a profound impact on whether the other person, the identified client, actually benefits or not.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So this is an interesting kind of segue. What I plan to talk about next week is mindfulness meditation and loving kindness meditation from a psychological perspective, not from a Dharma perspective. Well, Dharma will come into the mix, but as I said earlier, I professionally was a psychotherapist for decades, and I know a lot. I used to teach continuing education unit courses to other medical professionals and mental health professionals about mindfulness and loving kindness and its therapeutic effects. So I'm going to talk about that next week. So it won't really be a traditional Buddhist Dharma talk, but I think it does explain how mindfulness can be applied in a variety of ways, not just in terms of therapy, but also in terms of relationships and back to emotional intelligence, which I talked about, I guess, last week or the week before. And then just for y'all's information, beginning on next Friday, well, Friday after next, the 7th of April, I will be on self-retreat in this building from the 7th to the 21st. So there will be Dharma talks, but they will only be via Zoom, and they will be hosted by people who I am mentoring as teachers. And April will be, well, you won't be one of them those 2 weeks, will you? It'll be Leslie and Allie.
That's right.
So just so you know, that there'll be good talks. They're going to be talking about the Buddha's life just prior to awakening and about the First Noble Truth. The second talk will be about the First Noble Truth. All right, so as our custom to sit together for a moment, so let's do that. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well, and I hope that we're all reasonably safe and happy till the next time we have a chance to chat.